I went so far in the evening as to make a beginning. The weather had changed back, a great wind was abroad, and beneath the lamp in my room, with Flora at peace beside me, I sat for a long time before a blank sheet of paper and listened to the lash of the rain and the batter of the gusts. Finally, I went out, taking a candle. I crossed the passage and listened a minute at Miles' door. What, under my endless obsession, I had been impelled to listen for was some betrayal of his not being at rest, and I presently caught one, but not in the form I had expected. His voice tinkled out. "I say, you there, come in." It was gaiety in the gloom. I went in with my light and found him in bed, very wide awake, but very much at his ease. "Well, what are you up to?" he asked with a grace of sociability in which it occurred to me that Mrs. Gross, had she been present, might have looked in vain for proof that anything was out. I stood over him with my candle. "How did you know I was there?"
"Why, of course I heard you. Did you fancy you made no noise? You're like a troop of cavalry."
He beautifully laughed. "Then you weren't asleep?"
"Not much. I lie awake and think."
I had put my candle designedly a short way off, and then, as he held out his friendly old hand to me, had sat down on the edge of his bed. "What is it," I asked, "that you think of?"
"What in the world, my dear, but you?"
HPPodcraft.com.
Oh, go on.
Ooh, that's the creepiest thing in the book. I want some sure kid is. Laying awake thinking about me. The book that I'm talking about is, of course, The Turn of the Screw by Henry James.
That opening bit we heard was from the 17th chapter, and this week we are wrapping up this classic of literature.
It's always when we reach the end of the novel that I mourn for the bad jokes I never made. Jokes that just wouldn't work now. For example, in the first episode, I could have started talking about Petruchio and Kate, and then you slowly realized that I accidentally stayed up all night reading The Taming of the Shrew. But you know that it took me like a lot of effort and time, so you don't say anything and we just do like four really confusing episodes, but somehow it works. I guess what I mean is, you know, you only regret the things you don't do.
That is so not true. That reader was once again Rachel Lackey.
Yes, thanks, Rachel, for making sense of this overwrought text. I really enjoyed this book, but I gotta say, I wasn't sad finally for it to wrap up. Or rather, it was making me really sad, so I was glad to snap it shut. But how about a quick catch-up?
Yeah, the story so far is this woman we know only as the governess has taken a job at Bly Manor to take care of two children, Miles and Flora. Her boss, their uncle, wants nothing to do with them, so she's in charge. Besides the housekeeper, Mrs. Gross, there's a whole slew of servants, but she's totally on her own. Miles was expelled from school for some mysterious reason, but now he wants to go back to school. He wants to get his uncle in on this, because whatever he did, he wants him to smooth it over, make it so he can go back to school. The governess believes that the children are secretly communing with the ghosts of Mr. Quint, a former servant, and Ms. Jessel, their former governess. What's the current governess to do? Creep around and spy on children. That's what. As we heard at the top, earlier that evening, she started to write the uncle, but then decided that it would be more fun to go creep on the little kid, and she got busted. She says that he should be sleeping, but he says, "Well, I think also you know of this queer business of ours, the way you bring me up and all the rest." And she says, "What do you mean by the rest?" And he goes, "Oh, you know."
Is there a musical adaptation of The Turn of the Screw? I bet there is. Anyway, the way that you just said that thing about her creeping, what's a governess to do? It sounds like that would be a song in the musical. Creeping on children, that's what. I think you know of this queer business of ours.
We've talked about how many levels there are to this, but what's really horrible is that all of the levels are terrible and sad.
They are, especially that throw off. He's laying awake thinking of her, but not just her. He's thinking of this queer business of ours. He won't say what it is. He goes, you know, the weird situation we have here with the way I'm being raised and all the rest. That all the rest is very loaded. And I had intended to read this book in one sitting, but ended up getting it in as we did the shows because of stuff that was going on. And I definitely have to say I finished it early this morning. You were...
I hope so.
You were right. I did. I'm not finishing it right now as we're doing it. I promise. Why, that? See? Another joke I should have been making the whole time. Like pretending that I knew what was going on. I've really just given up. There are all kinds of interpretations for this book, but at the core, you know, you've been saying this all along, I think it is a child experiencing shame over unmentionable things. We don't know what the scale of that abuse is, but
Yeah.
You know, having been a childcare worker in that exact situation, it all lines up. As I was reading this last quarter, I was grateful that the governess must have been sensing that and says, all right, we're finally going to have this out.
She says to Miles, you never talk about school, so I figured you had no interest in returning, because this whole him wanting to go back to school thing is news to her. Miles says that he wants to get away, and when she asks, what do you mean? He says, well, you know what a boy wants.
Yeah, he says he's not tired of Bly, it's just that. And I actually think it's pretty innocent, although it feels like a loaded response given, I mean, this is a pretty commonplace conversation, you know, in that he's just going, I want to hang out with other kids.
Sure.
It's not that I don't like it here. It's just not normal. And that's a normal conversation to have. But the subjective nature of the book has made everything look ugly. So he's being straightforward, but at the same time, it feels creepy.
He insists that his uncle come to Bly and settle things with her about school. And she says that you can't go back until you talk about what happened. And he says, I don't want to go back. I want to find a new field, is what he says. So basically a new school. Again, dodging giving her a straight answer about what happened. But for some reason, she feels the need to kiss and cuddle him at this point, and he asks to be let alone.
She has the sadness about it that I thought was touching. A sense that, and I think the whole conclusion is saying this, that unless these unsaid things are dealt with, put into stark light, into actual words, the issue is going to continue to cause misbehavior. The symptoms will still be there. But, you know, when he says he wants a new field, he said it with admirable serenity, with positive, unimpeachable gaiety. And doubtless it was that very note that most evoked for me the poignancy, the unnatural, childish tragedy of his probable reappearance at the end of 3 months with all this bravado and still more dishonor. It overwhelmed me now that I should never be able to bear that, and it made me let myself go. I threw myself upon him, and in the tenderness of my pity, I embraced him. It's this emotional outburst that's the result of really seeing the tragedy here. He's unaware that he can't run away from the problem. He's too young to know that. Well, also, she's learned a little something within the book. We've seen her go on a journey, which is, you know, you can't just kick the can down the road. She tried that on the issue of school.
Mm-hmm.
She goes, I don't want to deal with this. And now he's doing the same thing by just saying, nah, I'll go somewhere else and forget it. And I think that's the message of a lot of ghost stories. And a lot of times they fall flat, as we've noted, because they're about unresolved things that need to be resolved. But once those things are explicated, as they often are, it was a murder or some money was stolen or whatever, it turns pulpy, you know, now it's a ghost coming to get revenge or whatever. So not talking about the core reality in this book does give it the power of real life, you know, where nothing really is explicated. People don't really talk about what's really going on most of the time. There's a deep core of terrible stuff happening a lot with people that you've had very casual conversations with and you don't know it. And that's going on all the time.
Yeah.
And this book nails that reality by being so oblique.
It's sad and it's horrible. Obviously, whatever happened to this boy, whether it was sexual abuse or it was some other kind of abuse of some kind that this guy did to him, that's going to be with him his entire life. And if he doesn't understand it and process it and put it in its place where it needs to go, it's going to not just affect him, it's going to affect other people.
Yeah, not to put too fine a point on it, those ghosts are just going to keep hanging around him.
Yeah. She finally asks him directly-ish what happened at school, but then a cold breeze comes in and blows out the candle, and she thinks, well, the window's closed, and so she asks, why did the candle go out? And he says, it was I who blew it, dear.
Hey, for a moment, I thought we were going to get a cleansing bolt of lightning or, you know, some kind of great romantic earthquake or something. It says it was the response to her question was an extraordinary blast and chill and a shake of the room as if in the wild wind the casement had crashed in, which is just a result of the wind. But for a moment, I thought, what's going on here?
Mm.
And then it said the boy gave a loud high shriek, a note either of jubilation or of terror. And I think that was the moment when it was like, yeah, I get it. It could be great or it could be scary. You know, it's like when you've gone to a magic show and you were amazed by something, but then you realize, oh, that was it. Like, that was the biggest trick. And now this whole last 20 minutes I got to watch knowing it's not going to be as good as that. You know, I've seen the main trick now. All this ambiguity at this point, it just happened suddenly. Right on that sentence.
Sure.
It was a cry of jubilation or of terror. And I'm like, I get it. Let's get to the goods.
So the next day, Mrs. Gross asks if she has written the letter, and she says she did, but she doesn't say whether she sent it or not.
She's got it in her pocket. And again, I know I'd hit that threshold because I just thought, throw it out now. You're not going to send that letter. Too late for the uncle to show up, Henry James. He's not going to, I know your game.
So the kids do amazingly well with their studies that day. And in the evening at dinner, Miles asks if she would like him to play the piano.
Yeah, he's a little gentleman. He puts on his giant fur coat, his rings, his cravat. Little Liberace.
He plays for a long time and he's good, but then the governess realizes that Flora is missing.
Yeah, he snake charmed her. I mean, she actually kind of dozed off in her chair, which is made me laugh because she's not even kind of a match for these kids. It's like he pours her a glass of NyQuil. He goes, "It's an apple martini, dear. Drink it, you stupid."
Okay.
I mean, the piano trick, really?
She asks Miles where Flora is, and he just laughs. He doesn't know. He's like, why wouldn't I know where she is?
And remember, he's wearing that fur coat and the rings when he laughed. How would I know where Flora is? Ding, 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 ding.
She goes looking around the house, but she can't find Flora.
Which, again, why didn't she take him with her when she went to look for the other kid? That was what the ruse was all about, was him going to look for her and leaving him alone. I mean, that is the exact moment when you, classic 1930s, grab him by the ear, walk around the house holding that kid's ear. You'll go two rooms and he'll talk.
The governess goes to Mrs. Gross, who says that she must be in one of the rooms that you just haven't looked in yet. But the governess says, no, she's at a distance.
That's a great interaction between the visionary and the mundane right there, where she says she's at a distance. I had made up my mind. She has gone out. Mrs. Gross stared, without a hat? She's having like a vision, a supernatural, I see that she's left with a ghost. And she's like, well, that's, the weather's not right for that. It was just really funny. The governess somehow just knows that this is happening. And we were talking about how she would fit in with the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And I think that would be Dr. Fu Manchu has kidnapped the prime minister's daughter. Where is she? Governess steps out of the shadows. She's at the river with a ghost. She just knows where kids are and who they're with. That's her power. And then she looks around. She goes, what the f- Tom Sawyer doing here?
They decide that she must be with Miss Jessel. Mrs. Gross notices that Miles is gone, and the governess thinks he must be in the schoolroom with Quint. Oh, well, she doesn't bother. She's going to go, we're going to go out. He did this whole thing, was a ruse so that he could go hang out with Quint.
Okay, so I have to say, this is the one thing in the book I didn't understand. Why does she just abdicate protecting him here?
I don't know.
She says, oh, he's with Quint. They're in the schoolroom. So she's just as sure of that. Mrs. Gross says, well, you're just going to leave him up there? She goes, so long with Quint? Yeah, I don't mind that now. And Mrs. Gross goes, because of your letter? Thinking because the uncle's going to come or something that you don't care?
Yeah.
And she doesn't really answer that. So it's I don't understand why she's okay with that.
It could be because I want to say that she has given up on him because he's been so tricky with her. But then again, that's not how it plays out. What we soon find out in the next chapter is that Flora is the one that she gives up on. Maybe she's already giving up on these kids and she thinks, well, maybe I can save Flora. And in this next chapter, we're going to find out.
Yeah, yeah.
And then she goes, well, I couldn't save Flora, so I'm going to go back. Now I'm going to try and save this guy.
Yeah, I don't know. The only thing I could think, too, is that if the backstory is that Miss Jessel and the girl would hang out so that Quint could go off with the boy, isn't that kind of being repeated here? His ruse, and then she goes, I have to go after Flora because she's outside. Like, she actually has left the house. I have to go get her, no matter what's happening here. I would think she could have taken Miles with her, but then she just thought, well, you know what? While he's occupied with that, he's not going to go anywhere because he got what he wanted. So this is the only safe way for me to do it, I guess is what it is. But what happens is she goes and gets distracted by those two while, he's up there with Quint, and then realizes that, like you said, oh, man, I have to give up on this and go back and deal with the core problem, which really made me lean more back towards what you were saying.
Yeah, and there's all these parallels, too, with Jessel. Obviously, I don't know how complicit she was in whatever happened. It seems like that she knew what was going on and didn't do anything to stop it, maybe because of her relationship with him. Maybe he was abusive to her, or she...
Or, dude, was she going through the exact same thing as the governess? Because, when the governess decided she was going to write a letter to the uncle, she went up and saw Mrs. Jessel writing a letter. She went, oh, she's a love letter or something, but she was maybe...
No.
Repeating the experience that she's having now because maybe she saw something. You know what I mean? So it's hard to tell.
Yeah. Mrs. Gross asks about the letter, and the governess takes it from her pocket and she puts it on the table so that Luke can mail it.
Mm-hmm.
Luke? Luke is one of the servants that gets named at this point.
Yeah. I had the same reaction when they mentioned his name. And I actually think Luke did too. He looked up and went, what? I'm in this book? the hell? This far in? Luke goes to like a support group with other characters who just were invented to, you know, deliver a letter or, you know, some bad news or
break some tea.
Brew some tea, drive a carriage, except he goes, yeah, yeah, yeah. See how you guys are all doing stuff? I was invented to not deliver a letter. I actually didn't even do any. My whole existence is predicated on not doing something. You know what it's like to live in the absence of any characterization? Oh, man. What a depressing life Luke had.
Gross doesn't want to leave Miles alone, but they both agree that they need to go outside and find Flora.
Yeah.
This is in the next chapter. They go to the lake where the governess saw Jessel before. They noticed that the boat is missing and think that maybe she went out onto the lake.
Yeah, first when Flora wasn't where the governess said she would, she looked a little crazy, but the fact that the boat's gone means, oh wow, it's even more sinister than that. There was an interesting interaction here. It says she's taken the boat, she's used it to go over, and then has managed to hide it. Mrs. Gross says, all alone, that child? And the governess says she's not alone, and at such times, she's not a child. She's an old, old woman. And what's that about?
I guess it's the influence of Jessel on her, but Jessel isn't an old woman. I mean, even by like time standards, if she was in her mid-20s when she was a governess, you know, yeah, those kids aren't that old. So 5 years dead? So like she's like 30 years old? So she's not an old woman.
Yeah.
But maybe she means that the things that she's experienced and seen has aged her to the point that,
right,
you know, she's become cynical and experienced the hardship. She's had to grow up in a way.
It's her manifesting her very adult. The adult nature of her mind that she hides from everybody. You can see in those moments when she's being deceitful. But that old, old woman thing, it was almost like addressing that there's this ancientness to it or something. It's a specific choice of phrase, and it comes up again in a bit, so I'll call it out then. But by the way, I am definitely working into my vocabulary. I'm going to go, and she's not even that old, not even by time standards. Which is what you said. It is awesome.
I did say that.
If you're not going by time standards, pretty old. But if you're going by time standards, not really that old.
So they go to the other side of the lake and they find the boat and look for Flora around, and eventually they find her. She's just standing there in the grass looking at them, smiling, which is very creepy. Mm. She picks up some withered fern as she waits for them to approach. She doesn't go to them. She waits for them to come to her. So Mrs. Gross runs up to her and hugs her. She's relieved of the worry that she was having because she thought, obviously, you know, this kid could have drowned in the lake. So she's just happy that she's okay. And Flora asks where their hats are and where Miles is.
Right. She's pulling that old Donald Sutherland trick, you know. They're like, what are you doing out here? And she goes, whoa, wait, first of all, where's your hat? Let's talk about that. Why aren't you wearing a hat? That's the real question. But the governess... She's changed. You know, she's not, these things don't work on her anymore. She's actually learned a few things. So I feel like that's the, you know, in the third act, the character comes in with some kind of special knowledge. And for her, it's to ask direct questions. That's it. And it's going to make things uncomfortable, though, because the monster hates light. That's what drags us through to the conclusion of this.
Yeah. The governess asks her straight out, where is Miss Jessel? And just then, the governess sees Jessel on the opposite side of the bank, and she grabs Miss Gross, and she says, look, there, she's there.
Ooh, it was an exciting moment. I thought, here it is. We're going to know whether she's crazy or not, or whether anybody else can see this stuff.
Flora gives the governess a dirty look when she does this, when she points her out. And then Mrs. Gross, unfortunately, can't see Miss Jessel.
Damn it! It's the first time this has happened where the ghost appears with other people around and it's a total bust. So the real power of the antagonist is revealed here, that just because you have had a personal revelation about honesty and directness, and because you can see the problem, you're still in a world where that's not policy. Nobody else can see the ghost. So given that, it now makes the letter and all that stuff futile. You know, good luck with the uncle should he arrive, even if he decided to come. You'd go see there's a ghost over there and he wouldn't see it, and he'd bundle you off to the loony bin and put another governess in place here. Mm-hmm. You know, I did get hooked back into the book here because the governess really realizes that there's nothing she can do. She even gets a bit rough with Flora, I thought. It says, to see her without a convulsion on her small pink face, to not even feign to glance in the direction of the prodigy I announced, but only instead of that turn at me, an expression of hard, still gravity, an expression absolutely new and unprecedented, that appeared to read and accuse and judge me. This was a stroke that somehow converted the little girl herself into the presence that could make me quail. I quailed even though my certitude that she thoroughly saw was never greater than at that instant. Because it is true, man. If she went, there's a ghost right there, and the girl didn't even look?
Yeah.
And so the governess says, "She's there, you little unhappy thing. There, there, there." And you see her as well as you see me. I had said shortly before to Mrs. Gross that she was not at all these times a child, but an old, old woman. And that description of her could not have been more strikingly confirmed than the way in which, for all answer to this, she simply showed me without a concession an admission of her eyes. A countenance of deeper and deeper and indeed suddenly quite fixed reprobation. So she confirms that I know she's there too.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's that old woman thing.
Mrs. Gross is a bit freaked out by all this and she pleads with her for them to return home. Flora demands that Mrs. Gross take her away from the governess.
Yeah, I mean, Mrs. Gross, she isn't there, little lady, and nobody's there. And you never see nothing, my sweet. How can poor Miss Jessel, when poor Miss Jessel's dead and buried? We know, don't we, love? And she appealed, blundering into the child. It's all a mere mistake and a worry and a joke. And we'll go home as fast as we can. Mrs. Gross is pretty much turned on her. It's not that she doesn't necessarily believe her, but she doesn't want the kid to witness this adult losing her mind. So, you know, that just didn't go well.
Right. Or it's about her maintaining the lie and the obfuscation where, you know, we don't talk about bad things.
Like, boy, that was uncomfortable, wasn't it? It's okay, sweetie. We'll go, let's go have some Jell-O.
And not deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, the governess seems to believe that Flora is now possessed by the ghost of Jessel and tells Mrs. Gross to just take her away.
Yeah, or under the influence, not necessarily possessed.
Oh, sure.
Like she learned from her.
Yeah.
Because it says the wretched child had spoken exactly as if she had got from some outside source each of her stabbing little words. And maybe that's, you know, if you wanted to have a lighter tone to this, that's simply what the corruption is. It's hanging out with lowly, you know, working class adults who teach you bad words.
Teach you mean things, how to be cruel to people.
Yeah.
At this point, the governess cries, saying, "Of course I've lost you. I've interfered, and you've seen under her dictation the easy and perfect way to meet it. I've done my best, but I've lost you. Goodbye."
Jessel told Flora, "Don't ever cop to seeing me. She'll look like a fool." So she got that technique from the ghost.
Gross takes Flora away, and the governess stays out there for a while and has a bit of a cry.
A bit. She puts her face to the ground and sobs. Face to ground sobbing. That's what she does.
Oh, Thursdays. When she makes her way back home, she notes that it's before the weekend. You know, the whole week's stress is built up and you need a good ground cry on Thursday.
Yeah, yeah. There's all these little divots. Chris playing golf.
She makes her way back to the house. She notes Flora's things have been removed from their room because they shared a room together.
Yeah.
She has some tea. It's brought to her by a normal servant, one that we don't get a name for. And she sits there thinking until Miles comes up and they sit in silence together. And the next day, Mrs. Gross comes into the governess's room and tells her that Flora is very ill. Flora is afraid to see the governess and doesn't want to see her ever again. The governess wants to know if she still insists that she's seen nothing. And Mrs. Gross confirms, yeah, she didn't see anything. And the governess believes that Jessel has such control over her now that when the uncle comes, Flora will say lots of nasty stuff about her. She'll make me out to be the lowest creature. The governess's psychic intuition says that Mrs. Gross needs to take Flora away out of the region so that Jessel will lose her hold on Flora. The governess is going to stay and try and save Miles.
It's clear Mrs. Gross doesn't have a lot of confidence in her anymore. I mean, she's also saying, "I'm just taking the girl away for a bit." It's almost like she's, like Mrs. Gross is dealing with a crazy person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a moment here where she says, "I'm on your side. I do believe you." But you don't know if that's sincere or not. I think probably it is, though, because she does leave her alone with Miles. And early on, you know, she did express that she feels guilty. She feels like it's her fault, Mrs. Gross.
Yeah.
She expresses that these sordid characters got influence over the children. So she does feel very protective of them. She must have some belief in the governess to go away with Flora.
I think she's complicit in whatever happened to them. Maybe not the supernatural aspect to it, but the stuff that did go on with Quint before.
Mm.
She was around during that. She also didn't do anything when he was doing his messed up stuff with the kids.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there is, I know I brought it up a few times, but her illiteracy, other than being somewhat probably commonplace, it's made mention of in here, and it doesn't need to be. It's made mention of again when Mrs. Gross cops to, she goes, "Well, really, I feel like I'm the one responsible here because the uncle didn't know Miss Jessel and Quint very well. I did. And I didn't really raise my hand. So, you know what? If we're going to do this letter thing, I'll write the letter." The governess says, "You're going to write the letter?" She goes, "Well, I have, you know, I dictate it to somebody else and they do it for me." And she's like, "Okay." Yeah. And so you're going to do that? You're going to talk about ghosts and stuff with somebody? And then she goes, "You know what? You write the letter." But that interaction was important because it's to the point that you're making. I think it's a thinly disguised way of showing how people, they don't have the means to talk about this stuff.
No.
This is a group of people who are functionally illiterate in these types of matters, whether you can write or not. You don't have the language to discuss this sort of thing, and that's why it's so hedged around the whole time. They actually can't write.
If this is about sexual abuse or any kind of psychological abuse that might have gone on, that nowadays people still can't talk about it. It's talked about more than ever in probably human history that these things happen and how they happen. And it's still hard to talk about. So like, if you had to try and process something like this 50, 60 years ago, like you said, you're not going to have the vocabulary. You're not going to know how to deal with it.
And I was making some jokes about the undelivered letter, but it does have a very important aspect, which is to show that when you do communicate about this, once the communication passes to one person, the likelihood that it's just going to exponentially increase is going to happen. So this whole idea of Luke not delivering the letter and this bailiff who's maybe going to take it down for Mrs. Gross, it's the idea that it contaminates. Once it's out, everybody finds out about it. And I think about those things all the time, say with them. You know, there was an actress during the Weinstein thing who said, I was pretty late to come out about this because when people see me in my old movies, I don't want them to go, oh, it's that person that was raped by Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
Because my work is still my work. Mm-hmm. Just the and when the violation becomes the thing I'm known for, then the violation happens every time that you think that. So it's like the disease in the missive, you know, the even just transmitting it is a, yet another abuse. That's the complicated thing. Because guess what? She's right. I've seen movies with her in them. And when she comes on, I think in my head the story I just told you. And so now that has done that to her again in my eyes, again with this letter. Once it goes out, it's almost, it's just easier to just keep repeating the same miserableness and not talk about it.
Yeah. God. Merry Christmas. So Mrs. Gross explains that Flora has been using bad language, stuff that she could have only picked up from an evil source, obviously Miss Jessel. This is proof enough for Mrs. Gross, even though she's never seen either of the ghosts.
And she's saying stuff specifically about the governess. About, she says, about you, miss, since you must have it, it's beyond everything for a young lady. And I can't think wherever she must have picked up. I thought it would have been funny, you know, like in good design, in good layout, they say break the rules once, set everything up just so, but then crash the frame or throw off the symmetry with one element. And I think it would have been funny if here Henry James did that. He says, all right, just to break form, I'm going to be super explicit in this one thing. And Mrs. Gross turns around and goes, well, miss, she called you a of and furthermore, she said on and everything. Wow.
Mrs. Gross agrees to take Flora to London to her uncle. The governess says he's going to know something is up because I sent him that letter, so be ready for that. Mm-hmm. But Mrs. Gross says, yeah, about the letter, Luke couldn't find it when he came in. It was gone. And she thinks immediately Miles took it and that maybe thieving is why he was kicked out of school. And she hopes if she can get him to confess that theft, he can be saved. Again, I don't know where she's getting all this from. Like, why does she think that one confession of a bad deed is going to get him out of this hole?
Yeah. Well, it's they're grasping at straws and they're like, oh, maybe that's it. Stealing. That would be amazing if he was just a thief, you know?
Yeah.
I do think that it's not, it is somewhat sound that if he confesses to that transgression and sees that it's okay, and that's a road.
Yeah. Now that Mrs. Gross and Flora are gone, the governess can focus on her upcoming confrontation with Miles. She notes that she's getting a lot of looks from the staff, but she's making sure she's looking remarkably firm, is what she says. They all think she's crazy, basically. She finds out from the maid that Miles had breakfast with Flora before she left. The governess is steeling herself for the fight against evil. It's dinner and she eats with Miles. He asks about Flora being ill and the governess assures him that she will be better soon. And he asks if Bly disagreed with Flora so suddenly. Maybe she's too ill to travel. And the governess poo-poos that. She says, no, no, she's fine. Don't worry about it. She can travel. And after they're finished, the waiter takes the plates away and Miles says, well, so we're alone.
Dun, dun, dun.
And he gets up and he goes to the window and he looks out and says, Well, I think I'm glad Bly agrees with me. She says that she stayed for his company, and he goes, for my company? That's weird. He says that he wants to talk to Luke, and she allows him to go and talk to him on the condition that he tells her what she wants to know when he gets back. Did he take the letter? And just then, she notices Peter Quint outside, looking in the window, doing his peeping, which was the custom at the time.
True.
Nothing weird about that.
Yeah.
The governess jumps up and grabs Miles, and she holds him close to her.
So he can't see the man. You know, earlier, when he turned to look out the window after she made the after he made the crack about being alone, it was like he was searching the grounds for Quint, trying to almost call him up. Just on that closeness of revelation, just when they're about to be honest with each other about this stuff, he can't get the image to appear. I thought that was interesting. But then here it is, and she won't let him look at it.
He confesses that he took the letter, and he says that he stole the letter because he wanted to know if she said anything about him, and he reveals that there was nothing about him in the letter, so he burned it. She asks if he stole letters at school, and then he gets offended by that, by her suggesting that he would steal. Mm-hmm. And she asks him, well, then what happened? What did you do? And he says, well, I said things. She says, only that? And he says, they thought it was enough. Mm-hmm. And then she says, but whom did you say them to? And he doesn't remember exactly. And he's getting flustered by the questioning. But she persists. And she asks how many people he said these things to. And he says, only a few. Those I liked.
And that's the contaminant there. You know, those he liked. Yep. I seem to float not into clearness, but into a darker obscure. And within a minute, there had come to me out of my very pity the appalling alarm of his perhaps being innocent. It was for the instant confounding and bottomless, for if he were innocent, what then on earth was I? They must have repeated them to those they liked, he added. He was shunned from the world of that school because the contamination, the secret, it got out. To her, a little revelation, all of this time I was mad at him for being duplicitous, for hiding the secret. There was a lot of language and a lot of feeling that he was in league with these ghosts and he wanted to see him. And I think in that moment you go, oh, he simply said something that he didn't know was bad. And then that was carried on and it was carried on and it was carried on. The act in and of itself was innocent. It wasn't a theft. It wasn't a bad kid thing. And they're having this conversation with the ghost looming there and him not seeing it. I thought it was a nice bookend to earlier when she saw Miles and he could see the ghost and she couldn't. It was a flip of that situation for our final little scene.
So she keeps pressing him and he starts to draw away from her and she realizes what she's done and she holds him again and he asks, is she here?
I seized, stupefied, his supposition, some sequel to what we had done to Flora, but this made me only want to show him that it was better still than that. It's not Miss Jessel, but it's at the window, straight before us. It's there, the coward horror, there for the last time. At this, after a second in which his head made the movement of a baffled dog's on the scent, then gave a frantic little shake for air and light. He was at me in a white rage, bewildered, glaring vainly over the place and missing wholly, though it now, to my sense, filled the room like the taste of poison, the wide, overwhelming presence. It's he? I was so determined to have all my proof that I flashed into ice to challenge him. Whom do you mean by he? Peter Quint, you devil! His face gave again, round the room, its convulsed supplication. Where? There are in my ears still his supreme surrender of the name and his tribute to my devotion. What does he matter now, my own? What will he ever matter? I have you. I launched at the beast. But he has lost you forever. Then, for the demonstration of my work. There, there, I said to Miles. But he had already jerked straight round, stared, glared again, and seen but the quiet day. With the stroke of the loss I was so proud of, he uttered the cry of a creature hurled over an abyss, and the grasp with which I recovered him might have been that of catching him in his fall. I caught him, yes, I held him. It may be imagined with what a passion, but at the end of a minute, I began to feel what it truly was that I held. We were alone with the quiet day, and his little heart, dispossessed, had stopped.
So a happy ending for this one. Oh, that's the end of the book, guys. The boy dies. So what happened there in the end?
There's a lot of different ways to interpret this. It could be on surface. You remember she said that Flora was ill.
Yeah.
Maybe he's ill as well.
Right.
And and he died from that. Like, it could be as simple as that, and all of this stuff is the governess being insane, and she's just made up this whole crazy story about this stuff. Or it could be, you know, a metaphor for his childhood, and childhood dies.
Sort of like on 30 Rock when Tracy invited people to his party and it said, no presents, please. And he's like, no, they got the punctuation wrong. It's supposed to say, no presents, please. You could read this last sentence a little different if it said, but at the end of a minute, I began to feel what it truly was that I held. We were alone with a quiet day, and his little heart dispossessed had stopped. You could also read it as, and his little heart dispossessed had stopped. As in, turning to confront Quint, who now vanishes, is when he transitioned into adulthood. He's not a child anymore. That was the passing of innocence. So maybe he didn't die. It's just that the child died. But in a good way. But that's good, because that's somebody who, you know, turned and confronted this thing, and it no longer had power when they could both look on it together.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, that's the uplifting way of looking at it. Which
I think I solved it. That's exactly what it's about. Yep, that's it. We cracked it. This is a happy story. They beat the bad guy.
Oh my God.
I'm glad we did it, but I'm also glad it's over.
Me too, dude.
I have to admit, as well as this year, we're going to be going into 2021 strong. We got good stuff that we've got lined up for next year. I think folks are going to really enjoy.
Yeah.
They're going to enjoy the schedule. We're putting it together now, but there's going to be good stuff there. I want to thank our reader once again for joining us for the whole voyage, Rachel Lackey.
Yes, she did a great job with it. Sometimes tricky, but she always pulled it off. God bless her.
I also want to thank our patrons, and there are 10 of them I have in mind right now. I'm going to start by thanking Ashley Kent.
Emil Phillips, thank you.
I want to thank Owen Zelenik.
Nick Brindlow, thank you.
Guadalupe Ubarra, thank you.
I'd like to thank Brian Haynes.
Travis Mays, thanks so much.
Noah Hyatt, thank you.
Kyle, you're the best.
And KD, thank you.
Thank you all. Those are all the strange studies of strange stories we got for you this year. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and we're at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.